Welcome to HWTP Sports Talk with your host, David Weinstein. And now, David Weinstein.
So joining us this week is Dr. Jennifer McLaren. She is a feminist media scholar whose research examines sports difference and consumer culture. She's currently an assistant professor of sports media and culture in the Department of Radio, Television, and Film at the University of Texas in Austin. But we're glad to have her on this week to talk about fighting visibility, sports media, and the female athletes in the UFC. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So Jennifer, I was also lucky enough to get an advanced copy of your book, which, as you can see, I've read and bookmarked. So there's a couple of things I want to ask you about. The first thing I noticed, and it didn't occur to me until I'd actually finished the book, the title itself can be viewed in two different ways. It's either altogether fighting visibility or fighting visibility. Did you intend for it to be that way, or did it just happen to come out like that?
I absolutely intended for it to be that way. So I'm glad that you picked up on that, because there's some subtle differences there. And I was, you know, really interested in this idea of representation and what representation can do for women's sports, because we have a sport like the UFC where women are more visible now than ever before in combat sports because of this particular promotion. And in a lot of ways, their visibility of their fighting is now more prominent than ever. But at the same time, I'm questioning this very idea, this premise that we have for a lot of advocates of women's sports will say visibility is the answer to inequity. And visibility, just increasing the visibility of female athletes, will get us so many things. But I don't actually know if that's true, because I think visibility can be profitable, and certainly the UFC makes money off of their female athletes, but I don't know if the athletes are actually benefiting as much as we think they are necessarily from that exposure.
And I think that that's a common problem throughout all sports that involve female athletes, especially team sports. There's a little bit more equality in individual women's sports. And it's strange that we have to talk about men's sports versus women's sports. It's just sports. For example, with golf and with tennis, although the purses lag behind those of the men's purses, they're certainly making more money as individuals. And individually, they're doing better. Now, are they more visible in those sports because they have their own platform and they're individuals and they're competing and they speak up for themselves? Or is it simply that it's a smaller field, and because of the way it's operated and what people before them have done, they're making more money? I don't think we see that same equality in other sports where women are just as visible. WNBA, women's soccer, and other events, more of team sports, women's hockey as well. And I think that ties in more a lot from what we're seeing in what you talk about in your book, this inequality where they're drawing in large purses for UFC, but they're not sharing those purses. And quite frankly, UFC is not really sharing the purses with the men on the men, all the men on the men's side either.
No, absolutely not. And one of the things that what I do in fighting visibility is that I'm focused on women, and because I'm very interested in women's sports, and I was very interested in this phenomenon of integrating women into the UFC after they said, never, 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 we're never going to include women. And then Ronda Rousey came along and they were like, ah, we'll try it. And then all of a sudden it exploded. And much to their surprise, it became really popular and Ronda Rousey ushered them into the mainstream. But as you point out, there's some really interesting things in the broader scope of sports media that I think we need to pay attention to that make the UFC a little bit different, too, because you're pointing out examples of team sports where something like the WNBA gets nowhere near the visibility of the NBA, for example, in mainstream sports media. And part of that is longtime stigmas of female athletes and what female athletes can do and how they bring in different audiences and they don't get the same level of exposure. They don't get the same level of investment. And we have this stratified, you know, idea that these are two different sports and that, you know, it's not the same fan base and it's not the same thing. Whereas something like the UFC or something like tennis, you have the same level of production value invested into those particular sports, the same level of promotion invested into those sports. And then with UFC, you have a men's fight and then a women's fight and then men's fight and then a women's fight. And so it's the audience is getting exposed to the talent in the same sort of way, whereas you're not getting that same level of exposure because it's not necessarily the same people tuning in for those team sports. So that's part of the reason, it's part of the answer to the question why women were able to become so visible within this particular sport.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
And the visibility that they created benefited UFC as a whole. You know, as you pointed out, 1993 was the first UFC event. In the 2000s, granted that's only 7 years later, women's events start to take place. But the real key event and what really took place here really was with Ronda Rousey. And that wasn't until, well into the 2010s. And as you point out, the Revolution video and that fight that was taking place really sort of rocketed, and then UFC just took off. And one of the things that you point out, and you had to read the whole book to get to this point, and I think it's a very valid one, is you point out in the coda, and I'm going to quote from you because it really hit home to me. The violence that fighting visibility discusses has less to do with bruises and broken bones and is more concerned with a promotion that refuses to take adequate responsibility for its athletes or to build mutually beneficial relationships outside of the promotion's superstars. To me, that's really a symbol and a symptom of what takes place in fighting, whether it's boxing, whether it's UFC. We've all heard the stories of the greatest boxers who were ever around who were taken advantage of by their managers. To a large degree, we're still seeing that in UFC, both for the men and for the women. Who's making the money? The people who are running the show. Who's not really making the money? Who's having trouble making ends meet? Who's sleeping in their car? Who's not driving a Chevy and they're driving, not driving a Cadillac, but they're driving a two-door compact car? The fighters. And so they're getting bruised inside the ring and outside the ring. This visibility that they have to fight for is really at the center of what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the way a promotion works, whether it's in boxing or whether it's the UFC, is that they're looking for the talent that is going to make them the most money. And that's a relatively small number of people, but they're constantly cycling through different fighters looking for the next new thing. And with the UFC, they've done some really interesting things with trying to market to different niche audiences by representing diversity. So they'll try to appeal to Black boxing fans, for example, by bringing in a Black fighter who has a boxing background, or Latino fans by bringing in someone like Cain Velasquez and marketing him as a Mexican-American. And then with women, it was the same thing. They thought, well, we have an avenue to open up a female market by bringing in women. And there's a way that they're making, no matter who they're bringing in, they're generating buzz. They have the fighters coming in and cycling through. They're looking for this talent. And the fighters really have to work towards getting those fights and getting that visibility. And so they spend a lot of their own labor in trying to self-promote and to promote themselves. But they're not getting paid by the UFC for that because they're independent contractors. And so the UFC is able to sort of determine who can generate the most buzz by the people that are making the most clamor or making the most noise. And so those are the ones that they take notice. And if they're also good fighters and they have a certain level of charisma, like your Conor McGregor or your Ronda Rousey, then they can really take off and make the promotion a lot of money. But the problem with that whole formula is that there's still people walking into that ring that don't have year-round healthcare coverage, that are literally putting their bodies on the lines, that are literally getting concussed because it's a fighting sport. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of concussion injuries. There's a lot of trauma that happens. And even if it's not concussion, there's a lot of damage that's taking place on athlete bodies. And so as independent contractors, I think it's a really problematic model to have them sacrifice so much of their of these years of their lives that they're trying to get that visibility, they're trying to get that paycheck, and the organization is making a lot of money on it, but yet the fighters are really not overall left with very much because they don't have retirement benefits. They don't have, they're not really, you know, paid enough because they are independent contractors. They're not really paid enough to be able to, you know, make ends meet in a lot of ways. And a lot of fighters face this because they're having to pay out what they get from a specific fight. They're having to pay out to their management, to their coaches. They have to pay a higher tax, higher taxes because they are independent contractors. And so by the time you take all of that away, there's not as much money left. And so it's a model that's lucrative. And if you look at other sectors of our economy, a lot of organizations are going this way. If you look at, you know, ride sharing, you know, it's a gig economy. So UFC fighters are the same.
And that's one of the things that really rings out and rings true in this whole thing. It's the fact that they make them participate as independent contractors. And so that means the burdens on them. And it's not just in having to pay your manager and having to self-promote. You talk a lot about what they have to do on social media in your chapter about the labor of visibility on social media. And again, that's all on you. Once you get followers, once you've received attention, once you're interacting with people, oh, okay, then the management at UFC is going to say, okay, great, look at all that. Okay, now we'll reward you with another fight. But to get to that point, that's all on you. And it's not just money, it's time. You have to interact with the people who are following you. You have to interact with what's going on around you. You have to be monitoring your Twitter feed. You have to set a schedule. You have to hire a social media coordinator, and that's where money's coming out of your pocket. More than anything else, the fact that they're fighting against unionization and what they've done to some of these fighters really struck me as the way that they're trying to marginalize these fighters. And while they get the visibility and while it's giving them visibility, they're really pushing back against them.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
In one of the chapters in your book, you talk a lot about Leslie Smith and her defining moment in 2017, which is not that long ago, at a retreat that's sponsored and held by the UFC, where they're spending a lot of money on guests. They had Snoop Dogg there. There was all sorts of everything flowing from, you know, one end of the room to the other. Kobe Bryant's there. And she comes up and asks a very poignant question to Kobe Bryant, which is, what is it about the players' union? How does that help you? Do you think that would be good for us? And his answer is, to summarize, yes, that's why we're so successful. That's why what we're doing. Well, guess what happens to Leslie Smith? You don't have to read the rest of the book to know what the answer is there. Guess who doesn't get another fight? Guess whose contract doesn't get extended? Because she's fighting the management.
Yeah, exactly. And because it's such a lopsided relationship, if you look at, you know, it's hard to get access to UFC contracts, but it's through legal proceedings that you can see, sometimes you can see what these contracts look like. And they're very lopsided, and it gives the UFC a lot of power to, you know, decide they are not going to fulfill a contract, for example, or, you know, they don't have any, of course, any obligation to sign another contract if they decide that they don't like a particular fighter. Or, you know, they can shelve a fighter, meaning these contracts can last for indefinitely. And that's one of the things that the Ali Act, for example, which does not apply to MMA, helps prevent, because there's a term limit on contracts. Well, the UFC fighters don't have any of this. And so they have very little power because these contracts are really written in ways that don't give them a lot of opportunity and a lot of rights. And the UFC is the largest MMA promotion in the world by far. And there's really no competition in terms of other promotions that are as lucrative, even though they're not all that lucrative for fighters, but B, are as visible as sort of the top tier of the sport. And so there's no real competition. And so those things combine to make it very difficult for fighters then to to break out and to stand up, because they're all constantly worried about repercussions, because it's so easy to be cut. And there's so many fighters that are wanting to get into the UFC. There's this constant generation of interest in fighters wanting to get in. So they feel a lot of them feel very expendable. And, you know, this is for, I'm talking about mid-tier fighters and below. The top-tier fighters do tend to have a little bit more power, but you see ones like John Jones, who's a huge name. He's really advocating for himself to get paid a lot more right now. And he can have that certain level of visibility and arguing against his, you know, against the UFC for being unfair, because he is such a household name if you're a UFC fan. But the rest of the fighters on the roster, once you get outside of the superstars, they don't really have that power. And so it's a very lopsided relationship. And a lot of them really do fear that retaliation. And then there is evidence that fighters have been retaliated against, not in a legal sense that's been proved in a court of law, but in terms of how they describe their own experiences.
And I think that's a lot of what we've seen over the course of history, just with boxing. I mean, a lot of that before the Ali Act came into play and before some legislation and reforms took place, I think that history tells us that that's a lot of what happened with boxing. Now, MMA is still young and UFC is still young. It's, you know, only been around since the early 90s. Boxing was around for a very long time, and it's only of recent vintage that people have started to protect boxers and started to look out for them. And very short career span for these type of athletes because of the punishment they're taking on a daily basis. But it's a sport that's very popular because of the violence that's associated with it. And so these fans are spending a lot of their money, spending it a lot quickly, and enriching the pockets of people who own it. Now, that's not to say that that isn't what happens with every other sport that we all watch. Look, the NFL is the king, and those owners are billionaires, and the money they're raking in is billions compared to a couple hundred thousand that some offensive lineman or defensive lineman or somebody at the low end, comparable to that second tier of fighters, is making and putting in their pockets. So it's not an uncommon theme throughout sporting, but I think that it's accentuated in something like UFC and MMA because of the small number of people who are involved, the limited number of matches that are available for people to see, and just the way that people are chewed up and spit out through the process there.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is you've got a whole chapter that's devoted to Ronda Rousey effect and the Rousey effect. What do you think it was about her that caused everything to just ignite, take fire, and take off? And then not just for the woman's side of things, but for everything that's connected to UFC. And now she's gone. But does the effect still linger?
It's a great question. So when I was researching this book, I was hoping to find a different answer to the question, like maybe Ronda Rousey didn't start at all in the UFC for women. But everybody I interviewed and every journal article that ever analyzed it pretty much pointed to this moment of Ronda Rousey coming around as being the moment. And so what I did is to try to figure out why that was. And in my work, I look a lot at cultural context to try to understand why a particular phenomenon would happen at any given moment, because it's not just an individual. It's not just Rousey herself, but what is the perfect storm? What is the conditions that enable something like that to come to fruition at a particular point in our cultural history? And there's a few different things that were happening. So part of it was that the promotion itself was more open to the idea of including diversity as something that could sell. Like I mentioned earlier before, it's this idea that their market isn't just one thing. There's a lot of niche audiences that make up that market, that some are international, some are domestic, and there's a lot of ways that they can slice and dice it. And they were open to the idea of bringing in different ethnicities and different nationalities. And so they had this formula for developing different markets by representing someone who looked like that market. And so that was the first thing, because they then translated it to thinking about female fans and how Rousey could develop. Because they told me actually that Ronda Rousey was more popular with women than with men. And that was an aha moment for them.
Let me ask you a question there. Do you really think it was the people at UFC trying to attract more female fans, recognizing that Ronda Rousey was very popular with female fans? Or do you think there was some sexism involved in there too? We can attract twice the crowd because we can get females who are interested in watching this. And from a purely sexist standpoint, we can get a different side of the male crowd who's going to be interested in it just because it's two women who are fighting each other.
I didn't come across anything that would rule that second one out as a possibility. But in the people that I talked to a few people in the marketing department, and I analyzed other interviews that they did with, you know, places like Adweek or Forbes or things like that. So I collected all of that. And initially they sort of marketed her like most sports organizations market female fighters, and that's to emphasize the sex appeal for male fans. Mm-hmm. But then as she started winning fights, as she got more popular and they were looking at their data, because they do a lot of research on who's watching which fights and which markets they might cater it to, and they realized that she was more popular with women. And her particular brand she's very charismatic, which is another feature that propelled her popularity. She has this personality that's edgy and can push buttons and can be abrasive. And that maps well onto fighting. She can trash talk, which is important. A lot of the really marketable fighters will trash talk and will sort of puff themselves up and do this whole display that's part of the pageantry of fighting. So that's part of it. And another part of it is that broader culture, when we think about mainstream culture, at that particular moment was really interested in girls and women's empowerment. Mm-hmm. And Rousey's rhetoric of, one of the things that I talk about this revolution video, and it's very much this sort of rhetoric of a fighter who's kind of has adversity in life and has to overcome gender inequality just to get into the sport, and then she excels on the world stage. And that was a very popular, and it still is, but there was like a moment around 2015 when at the height of Rousey's appeal, that rhetoric was really starting to take flight in popular culture. For example, Rousey had this speech that she gave, it was like a monologue that she gave that the UFC happened to record about this idea that she wasn't a do-nothing bitch. So she wasn't this woman that was weak and fragile and just allowed men to take care of her. So this mm-hmm. idea, and it got really picked, a lot of people picked up on it in popular culture. Tina Fey wrote about it. Beyonce sampled it for one of her concerts. And so that, all of those factors, those things that I've mentioned, her star power, charisma, the fact that she was winning fights in spectacular fashion. Of course, we can't forget about that because she had to be an exceptional athlete at the time for that to even take off. Like she had to win. But she also had all this charisma. They had this formula for trying to break into particular audiences by representing, fighters that look like the people that they were trying to attract. And, all of this comes together. And this moment where girls and women's empowerment was really taking off in mainstream culture, all of that was the perfect storm for that to happen and to take off in the way that it did. And once the UFC realized that they could, Ronda Rousey was possible, now they're still looking for that talent that can be a Ronda Rousey. And they don't necessarily have it at the same level, but they have, they have fighters that they certainly do, seem to garner fan attention and are fan favorites. And so that they are marketing.
So putting the pandemic aside, was the buzz that she created on the women's side of MMA enough to make it and to keep it survive after she departed from the picture?
Yeah, I think so. And she stuck around for a couple of years. I think that was a good thing that, she had several fights. It allowed time to bring in like different audiences. I know people that watch Rousey fights that never watch any UFC. So it certainly did. It did allow for that to happen. And when she lost, I think there was enough interest in the women's divisions that it was allowed to, you know, it's sustained. And there still is, I mean, there's the women's divisions are still bringing in demographics that they don't necessarily, the rest of the fights don't. And so that's important to the UFC. They're very clear about that. And so I think it will maintain. And, you know, we may see another, you know, at some point we're going to see another star that may come close to Ronda Rousey. But, you know, of course, she's always going to be billed as the first and the woman that changed it all, even though there were a lot of women MMA pioneers way before that that built a lot of that.
She was the one who was most visible. As you pointed out, that's what gets you where you want to be. It's not how good you are, but it's how visible you are. And if you're good and you're visible, then you are going to be a star. And that's exactly what she did and made everybody else forget the people who paved the way and who laid the foundation for her to be a visible star for the UFC. On the labor side of thing, you know, we still see Dana White and we're still seeing how active and vocal he is and how rich his empire is. Are they making any headway towards anything that's going to benefit these fighters, or is it simply just not part of his method of making money to allow them to either unionize or no longer be these independent contractors? Or for that matter, is it going to take legislation like the Ali legislation to spill over into UFC to finally get these fighters the protections they need?
I think ultimately that's what, you know, there's a few things that are needed. One, they need, you know, the Ali Act needs to be applied to MMA because this would really help to protect the fighters. And take away some of the power of promotions, and not just the UFC, it would be applied to other MMA promotions. The other thing is they really need to legally interrogate this idea that UFC fighters are independent contractors, because there have been several legal briefs that I look at in the book itself. And then also I interviewed Lucas Middlebrook, who was an attorney for Leslie Smith. And one of the things that they all say is that the UFC fighters aren't actually independent contractors the way that they're treated, because there's a huge level of control levied over them where they don't have the same amount of agency and determination. Like, for example, the biggest thing is they can't fight for another promotion while they're under contract for the UFC. Now imagine you're an independent contractor and you're a painter and you sign a job and that one job tells you you can't work for anybody else. Like, you wouldn't be an independent contractor because that's not how it works.
Right.
So there's, you know, several ways that they leverage amount of control over fighters that really needs to be investigated in a court of law, frankly, because they either need to lessen that control and give back the agency to fighters as independent contractors, or they need to make them employees. Now, of course, this would be a huge hit to their current financial model, so they're not motivated to do this. But what we know of the history of labor in the United States or around the world is that big entities are not always going to do the right thing for the workers that are lower down on the levels of power within the organization. So things have to be done legally in order for them to take notice, in order for them to make change.
You're listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, recognized by our guests and listeners for our no-holds-barred good questions and informed conversation. Don't be shy. Post your questions and comments at hashtag AskHWTP.
The other issue is that there's currently class action lawsuits against the UFC for basically arguing that they control the market to a degree that is unfair. Because fighters can't shop around with other promotions to get better pay because the UFC drives the wages down and kind of controls the market. So all of these things, you know, have been tried or are in the process of being tried. But I think they all could give avenues. And like fundamentally, what I say in the book is, yes, it would be a drastic change to their current financial model to suddenly start taking care of their fighters or have to take care of their fighters,
right,
and think about them as long-term investments as opposed to something that is expendable and not their responsibility because they're independent contractors. But I think that's the very reason why the model should be investigated. They take pride. The UFC takes pride on being having a lot of ingenuity and being able to be first and be creative in how they develop their organization. Why can't they apply that to how they could better pay their fighters and better take care of them, you know, over the course of their career? I think that they really do have an obligation to do that.
We all know that the difference between having an obligation to do something and actually stepping up and abiding by that obligation are two different things, especially when the obligation cuts into the cash that's getting put into your pocket. So as we wrap up our time together, what lessons do you think other female athletes can learn from what you've seen happen with female athletes in the UFC? And is this something that can be applied to team sports? Because again, this is really an individual sports more along the lines of tennis and golf. Are there lessons to be learned that WNBA, women's soccer, women's hockey can take from this so that they can get the visibility, the protection, and monetize what they're doing with their professional sporting lives?
Well, one of the things I really advocate for in the book is coming together as athletes. And this would help, this would benefit female athletes, this would benefit male athletes, is especially in individualized sports, you have to have, you know, you have to stick together or else you are going to be, I mean, it, you know, exploitation happens in all sorts of, you know, work fields, and sports are no different. So having that collective voice is really important, whether it's a team sport or it's an individual sport. And if you look at the history of, you know, the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, or if you look at the WNBA, the WNBA has a very active, very strong players union. And they've done a lot to advocate for pay and for working conditions for their athletes. And so, and even in individual sports, I talk about I talk about surfing and how various organizations have come together to advocate for equal pay in surfing. And so I think that it's hard in individualized sports, like something like boxing, something like the UFC, where you really, you know, you're fighting people who I'm saying that you should join forces with. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's, you know, there's power in numbers. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that, that Project Spearhead, which was the organization that, that the association that, that Leslie Smith and Kajon Johnson were trying to put together to advocate for fighters. I think, you know, that was the very ethos of that, is that no fighter is an island and you have to come together. You have to join forces because you are not going to be powerful enough unless you're together, because one fighter is expendable in the UFC, but a whole roster of fighters is not. And that's the challenging, that's the biggest thing to surmount, I think, from a fighter's perspective in this whole issue.
Be visible and stay unified, and that'll be the way to profitability. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for taking time out to join us. It's your turn to tell people where they can find you and where they can pick up a copy of your book. It was really a very interesting read to me as both a sports fan and as somebody who is part of the social media and who follows the media to see where all this goes.
You can find the book at the University of Illinois Press. It's called Fighting Visibility, Sports Media and Female Athletes in the UFC, but it's also available at all the other online usual suspects. You can find me on Twitter at J McLaren, that's McClaren. And yeah, I'd be happy to interact.
Well, great. Thanks again for joining us this week.
Thank you so much, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to HWTP Sports Talk with David Weinstein, with a podcast that tackles all the controversial hot-button issues from the world of sports, recognized by our guests and listeners for our hashtag NoHoldsBarred, good questions, and informed conversation. Once a week, you can find me here on HWTP Radio. The show is produced and edited by Jacqueline Park and is a Sweet G Communications production. Thanks to our guest this week, Dr. Jennifer McLaren. You can find her on Twitter at jmclaren, two C's. You can also look for her book, Fighting Visibility, Sports Media and Female Athletes in the UFC, sold at all great book retailers throughout the internet and on your local streets. Remember, you can find a new episode of Huddling with the Pro Sports Talk every week at hwtpradio.com. Now be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at HWTP Sports Talk. Missed a show? Visit our website at hwtpradio.com and download our podcast onto your smart device. So goodbye for now. We'll see you next week.